Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. I'm Tom Edwards. On the show today, we're heading to the cinema with critics Karen Krasanovich and Tim Robey to find out what's on the screen in August. Plus, we'll discover the fascinating life of Maud Russell, a member of high society during World War II, who was painted by Matisse and a close friend of Ian Fleming. And we'll meet Charlie Fink, the indie folk singer who set his sights on the stage. All that ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Let's kick things off with a summer blockbuster, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. This sci-fi fantasy stars Cara Delevingne and Dane DeHaan as two special operatives who must save the metropolis of Alpha from a dark force. Before we hear what Tim and Karen have to say, let's hear a clip.
Welcome to Alpha, the City of a Thousand Planets. After centuries of peace and prosperity, an unknown force wants to destroy all we have created.
Agents Valerian and Laureline, you have less than 10 hours to find the threat and eliminate it.
Had to get it to work.
It's big, it's exciting. Karen, it's the most ambitious film since Avatar, some have said. It's certainly the most expensive independent film ever, and I think the most expensive European film ever. It's Luc Besson, we know him from Leon, Fifth Element. Sounds exciting. Is it all worth it?
No. I hate to say this because I like Luc Besson. I like what he tries to do. I like the risks he takes. I even really like his failures. And I love Fifth Element. I mean, everybody does. I mean, there was a shop down in London called Multipads for years and years and years. This is basically an attempted sort of sequel to that kind of style. Mm. It's very, very big in design. I mean, I work in the art department in film and television, and I'm agog with the amount of design and innovation and imagination that has gone into designing the aliens, the crafts, the planets, all these things. And there's some amazing moments in this, but unfortunately, I didn't find that the story really sucked me in as much as Fifth Element. Fifth Element was a relatively straightforward story with characters you could hang on to. And this one, I kind of just was kind of, can I look at my watch?
That's not a good sign,
no,
is it?
No, it's not. But it is beautiful, and it's really one past Avatar. It feels like Avatar had a secret affair with the Fifth Element and then gave birth to a slightly too long baby.
Okay, that's excellent. Tim, what did you make of it? Is this a question, and we've probably talked before about films that have this problem, you know, long on effects, long on design, long on big vision, but maybe short on, you know, plot and that sort of thing. Is this the problem here?
It kind of is. I mean, I thought that all the other stuff kept it going for a remarkably long time. I had a really good time with it for nearly 2 hours, which is basically your standard film length. I was really enjoying myself. Then I sort of realized that it was throwing all these things in the air to kind of disguise the fact that it doesn't actually have a story that really works. It's sort of postponing having a story until the third act, at which point you think, oh, well, that's a bit lame. And it kind of just all falls away, really, in the last half hour. But I have to say, the opening sequence, for instance, which shows how this kind of great off-world space station thing has been assembled by all these different colonies and different cultures coming together and shaking hands, is so sweet and so funny and one of the best things Luc Besson has ever done. And it really gets you in a good mood into the film. And I liked Cara Delevingne's performance somewhat more than Dane DeHaan's, actually. She I found very interesting to watch in this. There's plenty going on. Rihanna has a cameo where she kind of shapeshifts her way through this kind of slinky pole dancing number, which is really good fun. It's constant novelty. It's like a kind of a cabinet of curiosities. And you sort of go in one planet and out the next, and you see something crazy, and then you see something even crazier.
So, cabinet of curiosities. I wonder, though, Karen, actually, if we look at this sort of idea of the way this film was financed and the role that Luc Besson himself played in sort of driving that process through, do we look at this and think, you know, actually, you needed the, occasionally they're viewed as being a bit heavy-handed, you actually want a bit of that big studio input. Maybe that might have reined back on some excesses and kept a bit of the discipline narrative-wise? I don't know.
Well, I don't think the studio is generally good at looking at scripts, to be honest. I mean, I've seen more examples of really great scripts ruined by studios than the other way around. I mean, this isn't the 70s anymore, the 80s, where they actually stepped in and did something good. if it were, let's say, taken by Warner Brothers or Universal, or we realize that those are disparate, I think it probably would have been a worse movie. I think that there's a lot to recommend it. I didn't find that there was a lot of chemistry between Kara and Dane. Although I like Dane a lot, I, you know, watch him, you know, open an envelope. Thought he was kind of cool. I had a hard time believing he was a major, but never mind. Clive Owen coming in and being a general. Yeah, okay, we can get that. But I think the problem here is that we've got an abundance of beautiful visuals, of sumptuous, is that a person, is that CG, I can't really tell kind of thing going on. And it's very, very seamless. So they think you don't really need an exciting, you know, story to hang all those beautiful things on. Whereas Fifth Element had an interesting story. I mean, this is basically a will they get married, won't they get married story with some, you know, slinky pole dancing aliens thrown in.
I mean, here we go. Here's what I think the difference is between Luc Besson and James Cameron. I think Luc Besson has a much more fertile and crazy imagination, which is very enjoyable. But I think James Cameron has much better story sense in every single film he's ever made. His story sense is unbelievably good. Even when the dialogue is kind of clunky and bad, it gets you where you need to be to be excited about the next bit coming up.
But Cameron isn't European. He's a very strict, disciplined storyteller, has to be with the budgets and the things that he's trying to do. And I love the fact that Besson's influenced by comic books, by music. Why else would he have Herbie Hancock?
You know, that's great soundtrack choice in this, yeah.
Which is amazing. And I like that. I like the risks. And he takes risks that Cameron wouldn't do. Cameron would work hand in hand with a studio that would hold him back. He would fight them. He would make compromises. Where I think Besson, you know, he didn't take his own salary on this. He did take a big risk. And I think that he's kind of like, oh, well, you know, the French kind of, well, we'll try again next time.
Yeah, that's the trade-off. It's not a failure, though. I think it's kind of like partial success, actually.
So enough to recommend viewing, which you can do. Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets is out in cinemas around the world right now. A slight change of pace. We switch screens to Mordy. It's been a busy month for Ethan Hawke, who stars in this, as well as appearing in Valerian. In Mordy, he's the co-star of Sally Hawkins, who plays the titular character, an arthritic woman living with her aunt and brother in the 1930s. Tim, how does Maud's story develop?
So yes, this woman is in fact an outsider artist, and she was based in Nova Scotia in the 1930s. She's living really just with her aunt. She has the terrible problems moving with her arthritis. She's living this rather kind of dead-end existence, and she really wants to get out. And her kind of possible route to happiness comes in the shape, rather surprisingly, of this extremely grumpy and slightly vicious misogynist who takes her in as a housemaid, and this is Ethan Hawke's character. He kind of takes her in, and the rest of the locals are like, what are you doing with her? Because the only place she can live in his kind of hovel is in his bed upstairs. She starts tending to his house, and then she starts painting it. And at this point, we realize that there's this strange talent that she has, which is noticed by someone locally who kind of spots her painting flowers on the wall and stuff. And then she starts selling these little cards and kind of postcards and prints. And this is how she made her name. And it's one of those kind of artist biopic type things, a little bit like Pollock, perhaps we could point to, but with the kind of genders flipped in this case. And I think they're both really good in it. It's a very modest film. Irish TV director Aisling Walsh made it. And I think it has a lot of limitations in its kind of style, really, and it's kind of momentum as a film. But I do think that the kind of the central duo really pull it together, and actually both Ethan Hawke's instantly excellent in it, and I think Sally Hawkins gets better and better as it goes along.
Okay, let's hear a little extract. Here's a clip from Mordy starring Ethan Hawke and Sally Hawkins.
Let me tell you how it is. There's me, them dogs, them chickens, then you.
You want me here, don't you? Because I'll walk out right now.
Told you could paint fairies on the wall.
I think it looks all right.
Did you paint that happy little chicken?
Yeah, wanted to remember his happier days.
How much?
What's your price?
$5.
Not selling that one.
Already sold.
I'm finished it.
You can find Maud Lewis selling her paintings from the front steps of her little house here in Marshalltown, Nova Scotia. Mm.
Tim, I don't know.
Terrible trailer.
I was going to
really,
say.
Really, really bad
it's
trailer.
It's a bit gloomy.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't, it's not a siren song drawing me to the silver screen. Is that a bit of a mis-selling exercise there?
It's a tricky one. I think what this film is going to depend on to win audiences is actually what it can't get at the moment, which is sort of awards recognition. They're definitely going to be campaigning for them both to be nominated for things. And I think Sally Hawkins has a good shot because it's one of those roles. You know, if you think of the sort of roles that get Oscar nominated, it has a lot of those elements. At this point in the summer, they can't really set it on that yet. So they're kind of stuck with it, and it does seem a little bit glum. I think what keeps you going through it, again, as I say, that Sally Hawkins is playing a risky part here in that, you know, she's foregrounded with all these kind of mannerisms and tics, and you kind of could just kind of decide it's too much very early on. But I think she has a lot of extremely natural kind of deep down charisma and warmth as an actress. You can't help but kind of go along with it after a while and go along with her portrayal. Ethan Hawke playing much more unsympathetic role from the kind of classic Ethan Hawke role, I think. And he really does an interesting job. I think he reminded me of Nick Nolte in this film. He lowers his voice a lot. He sounds a lot kind of gruffer. He looks older. He looks more grizzled. And I can see how he could grow into that kind of role that Nick Nolte made his own in the 80s and 90s, actually.
That really sells it to me, actually. Mm. Does she paint little tiny flowers?
She does a lot of little tiny flowers, yeah.
And what about that point on Ethan Hawke? Because he didn't really sort of have a need to have a renaissance per se, but he's had a bit of a comeback. We obviously had Boyhood, and he's definitely on the awards kind of, he's in that kind of spectrum. Is that, I don't know, a high time to recognise a long career of a pretty solid body of work? Or do you think, is it bad for award seasons to get into that slightly more reflective thing where they say, oh, you know, it's his moment at last, this kind of thing?
I don't think you could say that about Ethan Hawke. He has lots of tiny little moments along the way. I think it's nice to be nominated for a subtle performance or a performance that's different, catches our eye. And you know a good performance because you want to watch him. And I'm really, really interested now because the trailer didn't do anything for me. It's like plinky plunky. They didn't spend very much on this. This is pretty bad.
Who the heck
made it? Don't even say the Irish Film Board. But, you know, you just think, oh, I'm just getting diabetes from this trailer. But if you say that these two are good, more chemistry, then I want to see it. And I think that Ethan Hawke is going from strength to strength. Even his failures are interesting. I mean, he was in Valerian with a kind of an electric cowboy role. He just wore a suit that lit up and then he laughed a lot and had some nose piercings. That was it.
I think, Tim, your face whilst that trailer was playing was instructive. I know that doesn't work on the radio medium, but it could be some new kind of
wincing.
It was pain.
They're just doing such a bad job of selling their own film. Why leave it to me, you know?
Against what the trailer tells you, Maudy, worth watching. It's out in cinemas now. Our next film may be called A Ghost Story, but it's not your usual spine chiller told around a campfire. Is it, Karen Krasanovich? Tell us about the plot of this particular A Ghost Story.
Okay, this is called A Ghost Story, but everybody that I talk to calls it The Sheet Movie. Just want to say that. I've been saying to my friends, hey, I saw a ghost. Oh, you saw The Sheet Movie. Okay, this is a movie that's written and directed by David Lowery, who did Ain't Them Body Saints and some other things. He's primarily an editor. He's edited more of things than he's directed, although he's directed quite a few. It's a story of Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara play a married couple, and there's foreshadowing what's going to happen. Is this a spoiler if I say somebody dies because it's a ghost?
Even the trailer gives that away.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Okay, well,
if it's a ghost story, someone's got to die.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Casey Affleck's character dies, and he is basically trapped in the house where he's living with Rooney Mara. And he is eternal, as we would think that ghosts are. So he has to watch time pass. Now, he is represented by an actor or something under a sheet with two eyes. I'm assuming it isn't really Casey Affleck, because why spend that money?
I mean, mocap is really sophisticated these days, just to turn someone into a sheet.
It's very innovative, and it's kind of the story that a child would imagine if dad died and mom was in the house. Dad would be trapped in the house and mom, you would have to watch. And it's that kind of thing. At first, it's ridiculous. You can't believe it. There's a scene in a morgue, which is really interesting. You think, wait a minute, the sheet wasn't that long before. Now it's real long. What's going on? But there are some real innovative moments that I don't want to ruin. It does stretch a bit, and there is a slight bending of logic toward the end. But it is a very refreshing take on death, eternity, and love.
Would that draw you in, Tim? Even see how Casey does with the old sheet over his head? That's an acting challenge, right?
I'm up for this, yeah. And Rooney looks interesting in it too. It's funny, talking about trailers, I feel as though I've seen that trailer for some reason about a dozen times, and something about that started to make me feel as though I was going to be kind of swept into a coma by this film, slowly but beautifully. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I did like the director's previous film, but it was quite mannered. It was like he was trying to be kind of do the new Malick. Or kind of, he was borrowing things from Malick from the 70s, Badlands, and stuff like that.
Cinematography was really great, yeah.
I'm here for it. I hear it's interesting, and I'm interested to see how it deals with the jumps in time and the kind of what kind of time period we're looking at, because that's one thing that the trailer doesn't give away quite smartly, is you don't know how much time you're looking at, so that's good.
And Karen, I was going to ask you, I'm interested in Lowry, the director, David Lowry. This is, a relatively smallish budget piece.
Oh, God,
but
yes.
He's got some big projects in the pipeline, if I understand it. So if he's doing, you know, Peter Pan movie or whatever it be, does he have the differing skill sets? Does it need a different skill sets to turn your hand between, you know, the small projects and the large? Are there any clues as to how he'll fare?
In a way, it doesn't matter, because the fact that he can make something on it, and you'll see with the time jumps, you'll see that, again, working in the art department, you know where they're skimping on stuff. You're thinking, like, wait a minute, that's not right. You know, you can see that he's actually skimping on some of the period stuff, because period stuff costs a lot. You're thinking they're saving a lot on the sheet, you know?
Is it some of the sheet's best work?
The sheet should be nominated for supporting, at least, if not wardrobe or costume. I think he's serious enough, he's gritty enough. He's got a lot of good ideas, and I think that it will be very interesting to see what he does with a bigger budget.
Excellent. Well, that is A Ghost Story, out on August 11th. Finally, today, we have Atomic Blonde, which stars Charlize Theron as a spy, Lorraine Broughton, on a mission to investigate the death of another agent during the Cold War in Berlin. Let's kick this off with a listen to this clip.
The clock is ticking, and everyone you get close to ends up dead.
Someone set me up. Someone from the inside. Now, this only ends one way. A bullet. Pizza, pizza, pizza,
pizza, such faith. Oh my God, I think I love you.
That's too bad. Pizza,
the sounds of Atomic Blonde. Tim Robey, what is this film exactly?
Well, what we have here is a comic book movie, really, and it's from one half of the team who made John Wick. One of them went on to make John Wick 2, the other one of them has gone on to make this. And it's a similarly kind of super-styled, slightly retro action flick, in this case about a kick-ass British female spy. And it looks amazing. It really does. It's such a stylish film in every superficial respect. The soundtrack is about my favourite soundtrack of all time. I'm going to put that out there. It's all the bands I love most from the late 80s. You've got Depeche Mode, you've got New Order, you've got Blondie, you've got The Cure. And it's just almost wall-to-wall those songs for like 2 hours, really loud, as lots of violent stuff kicks off. There are very, very long scenes where Charlize Theron kicks people downstairs for about 15 minutes. And then so they kind of crawl their way back up and she kicks them down again. She grabs one of us to hand and sort of bashes them around the head with frying pans. All that is very, very entertaining. It has no soul. It has no soul, this film. It is pure kind of
style. Does that matter? It sounds like a rip-roaring laugh riot.
It's really fun. My major reservation with it is that I like just that little glimmer of something, like in the Bourne films, the conscience that character has that gives him a little bit of depth. Or in Mad Max Fury Road, say, in which she really re-established herself as a major star, Charlize Theron's Furiosa in that has genuine rage underneath you. There's something real about the character. I feel as though this film never even gets anywhere near who Lorraine Broughton is. She's just very, she looks like an icicle. She's got this kind of peroxide hair and this long trench coat. She kicks ass. It's sort of like watching a really brilliant computer game play out in front of you. Plotting lacks kind of suspense and stakes, really. It kind of just jumps from one fight to the next. You don't really know why. On a good day, you don't care. That's what I'm going to say. On a bad day, you probably wish that they'd put a bit more effort into the storytelling.
This director, the directorial debut solo, is it a stunt double?
Actor, stuntman, writer, producer, and stunt coordinator. So let's say
stunt coordinator.
They're stunty people. Yeah.
But, well, I guess that would be my question then. In whichever manner of speaking, should he stick to the stunts? Or, I mean, that doesn't worry you. It sounds like fun, doesn't it?
It's just, well, yeah, I mean, I like vacuous entertainment myself. That way I know what to wear. I think stunts do need, I mean, I was thinking about John Wick had a soul, actually, and that's one of the reasons
really
why we liked
absolutely,
it.
It really did,
absolutely, yeah. So it's possible that he might need to actually up the script. If you can get the action right, then again, you'd go to Korea for action, really. I mean, they do that a great job. So I think the script is always a problem with this, And I'm wondering if maybe there's some soul was ended up on the cutting room floor.
And it's not just a soul thing. It doesn't matter if the film doesn't really care about its story and just wants to be rollicking, violent entertainment all the way through. And just, but unfortunately, it dwells a lot on the story that we don't really care about. It spends a lot of its time kind of saying, "Who? Which one's the satchel? There's some character called the satchel that they keep talking about. Where's the satchel? Are you the satchel? No, he's the..." And by the end, I just did not care who the satchel was. I could not have given two figs about the satchel. I was just like, shut up about the satchel and just get on and fight. So I just wanted it to shut up and be entertaining rather than carry on talking and be less entertaining.
But he's going to do Deadpool 2, which is kind of, oh no, we're already there. But this reminds me of something like Luc Besson would have done something like this years ago, but still had soul.
Yeah, and it looks so good. If you just want to sit back and like look at incredibly pretty neons bouncing off everything, I mean, it really looks the business. It looks like a Nicholas Winding Refn film, actually. It's got that same kind of look to it, that lighting scheme. I was very rarely bored by the style, but I was a bit by the story.
So stylish and stylized. A final note on this then. Is it sufficiently stylish and enough elan that it constitutes a good move for Charlize Theron, for example?
Yes and no, because she certainly comes in like all guns blazing and looks great and has a lot of attitude in it. But it's not the kind of great step forward for her that Furiosa was at all, because she's not really allowed to develop the character very much. And I don't think the film gets anywhere near who this woman might be or what her kind of... It kind of gives her a sort of token backstory, but it's very formulaic. In the end, you kind of think, well, yes, it's sort of, it's like a solid single rather than a home run for Charlize Theron, if you like.
Okay, but it's Money in the Bank. So yeah, that's Atomic Blonde, which still sounds like quite a lot of fun to me. Karen Krasanovich and Tim Robey, thank you for talking film with us today. We'll be hearing from Tim and Karen again shortly, but first, we're going to find out about the life of another Maud Russell. Russell was a British patron of the arts in the early to mid-20th century. She was painted by Matisse, had a relationship with James Bond author Ian Fleming, and lived in Montesfont Abbey, where she entertained the who's who of high society. During the Second World War, she kept a diary detailing not just the lives of these people, but also what life was like during the turbulent period, which her granddaughter Emily Russell has just published. And Emily joined Fernando Augusto Pacheco in the studio to tell him more about it.
She was a modern art collector. She was one of the foremost modern art collectors of her generation in England. And she was very well connected. She knew lots of politicians and she also knew lots of artists and writers. And she was lucky enough to have been married to a man who worked in the banking world. Her father was also a banker. So she had money and a very large country house called Mottisfont Abbey in Hampshire, where she would entertain all these people that she knew.
How did you find her diaries? You know, is there a story? Because, of course, the book is all about it. But, you know, did you knew where he was? Or
there had been rumours that she had kept a diary. And then when she died, we found that she had left her diaries to an art critic, the New York Times art critic, John Russell, who was a friend of hers. And he kept hold of the diaries for many years. We wrote and asked him if we could look at them, and he said he didn't want to share them with us yet because he thought there might be information there that she would prefer to keep private for a while. In 2003, she gave them to my brother. He didn't look at them. He kept them in a cardboard box on a shelf in his flat in London. It was only quite recently when my mother died and we started going through all the family papers and trying to make decisions about what we did with all these papers that I said, can I read the diaries? I'd like to read them. And I took them back to me to Chile, which is where I live. My brother and sister were very kind and they said, fine, take the diaries and take the family correspondence and you can be in charge of the sort of the history. I began reading the first diary, which begins just before the Second World War breaks out in 1938. And I realised immediately that there was really very interesting material there, not just for me as her granddaughter, but also for a broader public. Because of her views on the war, her reaction to the events.
How did she paint the war, actually?
Well, in 1938, one of her friends was Duff Cooper, who was one of the most prominent people who was in the group of people opposed to the appeasement policy that was the British government's position at the time. And she had German Jewish relatives in Germany at the time. And one of the first entries, actually, in the diaries is just after Kristallnacht in November 1938, when she flies to Germany to see her relatives and to ask them if they need any help. And she arrives in Germany on the day when Jews have been publicly banned from being outside. And she wonders if her own appearance might provoke some kind of reaction in the hotel that she's staying, but it doesn't. And she visits her relatives and they tell her quite a few sort of disturbing stories. And she then starts to apply for visas for them to come from Germany to England.
With all those characters, especially, you know, around the world that are mentioned in the book, you must have done quite a lot of your own research as well, you know, to put things into context. How was the process of research?
The research process was enormous fun. I had to do a lot. She mentioned a lot of people by just their first names. It took me a long time to track down who they were. And even the relatives, I didn't know that they existed. I didn't know. I knew that I had a German Jewish great-grandfather, but I didn't know that he had sisters and his own line of descendants from through them. And so I had to track down family trees and track down family members and find out who they were and which ones had survived the war, which ones didn't. It was a very interesting process from that side personally, and also tracking down the more famous people of the day, who they were. When she refers to someone called Clemmy, for example, I discovered that was Clementine Churchill, Winston Churchill's wife. And so there were lots of interesting bits of research that I had to do to discover who everybody was and who she mentions in her diaries.
We'll talk about some of those big names in a bit. But did you, reading the diaries, did you find a lot of things that you didn't know about your grandmother? Because I have a feeling a lot of things perhaps you knew from stories from your own family. But were you surprised about any revelations?
We are a very discreet family, and she didn't talk much about herself. So most of the things I found in her diaries maybe weren't a complete surprise, but they had always been like a rumour to me. Nothing had ever been confirmed. And so there is a lot of information about her relationship with Ian Fleming in the diaries, which confirms that they had a very close, intimate relationship, that they saw each other on a weekly basis during the war, they had have dinner together, that they talked about marriage, and that she was actually one of the most important women in his life at the time, she and his mother. That comes out in the diaries. And there were also stories about my uncle Raymond Russell, who died as quite a young man at the age of 40, who I never met. And I had heard things about him, but I found out from the diaries lots of information about quite a troubled younger years of his life. He didn't want to fight in the war. He was a conscientious objector. And eventually he did join up and went off to serve in India, actually.
There's a moving part in the book where she talks about losing her husband as well. That was quite emotional. I guess it was a bit emotional for you as well, you know, in some ways.
Yes, that was amazing when I read that bit. I never met my grandfather, but I'd been told that he was this very kind, generous person. And I happened to be sitting, I'd got that particular diary, I'd been given that particular diary when I was in London. And I was actually at the Tate Gallery, and I sat on the steps outside the Tate Gallery and I read the chapter when he died, and I was, you know, it made me cry. I found it so moving. I always knew that she was very fond of him, very affectionate, and that chapter just really conveyed to me what she went through and what his last week of life was like as he suffered from asthma and those last few days of him being ill. It was very important for me when I read that.
It is a very moving entry in the diary. Another thing, you know, as you mentioned, there's a lot of big names in the book. She was very well connected. Yeah. One of the things I thought was fascinating, that she was painted by Matisse as well. Can you tell us a bit about this story?
Well, she was good friends with Clive Bell and Raymond Mortimer, who were both prominent art critics in Britain at the time. And they had good connections with Matisse in Paris. It was apparently quite difficult to get Matisse to commission him to do a portrait. He didn't often do it. And I think there are only two English women that he painted as a commission. One of them was my grandmother. And she, in order to, for him to accept the commission, she had to show that she was an important art collector. And apparently the purchase of a Degas was crucial to his accepting the commission. So she went off to Paris and she sat for him for 5 days. The story goes that she found him not very good company, and it was a little bit difficult sitting there for him for 5 days. And eventually she chose 2 charcoal drawings out of the 5 that he did and took them home, framed them. But they weren't displayed ever prominently in her house. She always showed them on the stairs of her flat in London, which very few people used to visit. And occasionally when she would have friends around, she'd say, "Come and see my Matisse portraits, and what do you think of them? Do you think they're a good likeness?" And so there's a nice story in the diaries, the later diaries, when Stephen Spender, the poet, goes to look at the portrait and says that Matisse captured a sort of Byzantine look that my grandmother had, because it's rather a mournful face that it shows. And she wasn't entirely convinced that that reflected her character. But she was a very serious person, and I think he did capture something there.
Finally, Emily, did the book left you with a lot of questions about your grandma that perhaps you wanted to ask her in some ways?
There were many things I wanted to talk to her about after reading the diaries. I was 20 when she died, and so, of course, I did have an opportunity to talk to her, but I didn't know the questions to ask, as she didn't talk much about herself. I didn't know the answers to questions to ask, but for me, it was a huge privilege to be able to enter into her mind, get to know her better, reading her private thoughts. It was, you know, a marvellous experience for me, and I think there's a lot of information there which will also be of interest to a wider public, not just because of the people she knows, but because I think very importantly is her views of the war, her reactions to the unfolding events, her reactions to Dunkirk, her reactions to the various defeats and losses that happened, which reflected the British reactions at the time. That, I think, is a very good way of finding out what happened during the war through her eyes.
That was Emily Russell, author of A Constant Heart, The War Diaries of Maud Russell, 38 to 1945, which is out now, published by Dovecot Press. Now, before this week's Global Countdown, we're going to meet Charlie Fink, former member of indie folk band Noah and the Whale. More recently, Fink's been releasing solo material, and his latest album is called Cover My Tracks. The album's also been made into a play in which Fink stars. It tells the tale of an idealistic young songwriter who suddenly vanishes without a trace. The play opened to raves at the Old Vic last month and will tour the UK in September and October. Fink tells us about moving from the studio to the stage.
I sort of, you know, made four records with my band and sort of come to the end of touring with them, but was faced with the prospect of, you know, how to make another record, and I kind of wanted to do my own record. And, you know, we live in this time where we have a phone or something in our pocket that is pretty much the most entertaining thing that's ever been invented that has, you know, the entire 20th century, 21st century of music on it. And it's sort of thinking, why do we need more music? Why do we need another album? And how do you make people listen to it as an album? And then around the time that I was having this sort of these questions going around my head, I got asked to write music for a theatre show called The Lorax at the Old Vic, which was two Christmases ago. Then sort of working on that show, I just sort of fell in love with the process, and it made me think, you know, maybe this is the way to frame a number of songs as an album and have it performed live as a piece of theatre. And the thing that brings those songs together is story, and that's why they necessarily have to sort of be heard together. So it sort of gives a reason why to make an album rather than just put out a song.
Being told you're no good, that a job that you hate belongs in a special part of hell.
So Cover My Tracks is about a songwriter. You'll be searching for where this character came from. So a songwriter who's sort of at slight crossroads in what he's doing, and he meets this room service attendant who's a sort of passionate girl who has not yet found an outlet for her creativity, and he sort of convinces her to join a band with him, and they go off on this journey together, and they have an accidental hit. And this sort of leads the songwriter to go a bit introspective and eventually leads to him disappearing. And it's about the girl who he's met trying to find him, and he's left behind a book of songs that's in somewhat clues to where he might have ended up. And it's sort of a journey to find him.
But sometimes your future is waiting for you behind a hotel room door. I'd spent 20 years not living my life, then that wasn't my life anymore.
This is a character that David and I have developed, I suppose, but it's certainly a character that has some similarities to me. And there's definitely sort of elements that feel autobiographical. My sort of first job I had when I left school was working in room service. And the first song on the album and in the show is about this guy meeting this person who works in room service in Manchester. And I guess what this character is going through is that sort of quest to try and do something original in an era of entertainment, music and art, where so much has already been done, and trying to find like an original space for yourself. And so I can definitely relate to that side of it.
You stand for the tree, lean in to see, hey, where are you going, do you smoke?
It's funny, you would think that by being in a play, which is essentially what this is, a play with songs, you know, you would think that it would be more sort of repetitive maybe, because you're literally saying the same words every night, performing the same songs every night. But in a strange way, it has a life to it, which, being in a touring band, you eventually, you know, once you've toured the same songs for 10 years, you maybe don't quite have the same excitement connection to it. But there's something about the liveness of theatre that I think, because you're sort of trying to play off someone and you have to listen to them, that you really are, you know, very engaged and sort of in the moment. But yeah, it was pretty nerve-wracking to do. And also, you know, obviously the first shows we did with this were at the Old Vic. It's really sort of a baptism of fire to do your first bit of acting at the Old Vic.
Listening to you play guitar, oh, it was like a firecracker. Oh, it was like a firecracker.
That was Charlie Fink speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Cover My Tracks is out now, and for more info on where you can see the play, head to www.faneproductions.com. Now, to end today's show, here he comes. It's time for the global countdown. We welcome Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco to the studio. He's counting down the top five singles from a particular country. Faye, put me out of my misery. Where are we headed today?
We are heading to Hong Kong, Tom.
Oh, that's exciting.
I think it's a very interesting top five this week. But guys, sorry to say, but I was inspired about your excellent reviews of films. I went to the cinema myself yesterday to see 47 Meters Down. Mandy Moore fighting sharks. I really enjoy that. With some nice frozen lemonade. That's a tip for the summer.
Okay. Well, I've got to get a view from both of you on that.
It's no The Shallows, but it probably will do on a Friday night if you're drunk.
Exactly.
Yeah. Were you drunk, Fernando? Personal question.
I was drinking with the Tango frozen lemonade, which is quite good. The colour was blue, so I think
they
needed
quite a lot of vodka in that lemonade.
Yeah.
That's fine.
A lot of E numbers in there. Probably sort you out. Okay. On with the top five. So Hong Kong, I'm excited already. What's at number five?
Don't be bored yet, but number five is Luis Fonsi with Despacito. You know, the song's been number one everywhere. So it's not a surprise that it's there at number five. Number four, we have a singer from Hong Kong. But sometimes she's described as a Filipino, Korean, Chinese. I think her family is very diverse. Her sound, the song is called Frames. It sounds quite a lot like Nora Jones. So I think if you're a fan of Nora Jones, probably you would like this. And she also has a twin sister who is also a singer. Jill Vidal, but I don't think they ever do it together. They never did do it together, so
okay.
It's a shame.
They can come back to that, maybe.
Exactly.
I don't know. Do they not get on? Is there some sort of terrible dynastic dispute that's rolling around?
I didn't see anything in the gossip pages.
We have not researched this thoroughly enough.
I think they're fine with each other. Number three, that's quite sad, you know. But of course, after the death of Chester Bennington from Linkin Park, you know, the sales of their albums and singles, you know, rose immensely. But I think Hong Kong, it's a particular case because the band performed there four times. They had a massive fan base there. There was rumors that the band was going to play again this year. And I was reading an article, the South China Morning Post, that it inspired a lot of bands from Hong Kong as well, with a similar kind of style. You know, it was never my favorite band, but again, it was quite sad news. I remember when I was young, it was all the time number one on MTV. So number three, they have the single In The End, which is one of their major hits from 2000. Moving on to number two, we have Daniel Chan, another local from Hong Kong. The song's called Time Will Prove. And that's a very cheesy track, to be honest.
Okay. I was going to ask you if it was about bread making, but no.
Actually, I know what the song's about. It's about cherishing your loved ones. And his wife is in the video. I think she was a former model, and I saw an interview with him saying, you know, because she had to take care of the kids, apparently. And she said, well, you know what? She can be on my video as well. So
maybe it works on both levels. Maybe there's a bread-making subtext.
There's a few puns in there which are jumping out at me, but I should probably move on.
Daniel Chan.
Did you like that? So Daniel Chan, you look a bit dubious about that, Fernando.
Yeah, I think I prefer Janis Vidal. You know, it's slightly better. Sorry, Daniel. And number one song again, I was talking about Linkin Park. That's the number one song, actually.
So, Fernando, I wonder, wherever we are light in the next probably week or so for this segment, are we going to see this trend everywhere? Linkin Park at the top of the charts. We do tend to see it, don't we, when we lose artists, whether it's unexpected or people who've at the end of a long life, a long career, it always adds this sense of reflection. People want to kind of go back and revisit the tracks. Do you see that around the world?
Absolutely, Tom. This, first of all, the song is called Numb from 2003 from their album Meteora. It's true to a point, Tom, because actually in the albums chart, certainly Linkin Park, I think, went back to the US albums chart, the UK one as well. But in the singles chart, it didn't happen in many countries, especially to have a number one song. I think that was almost a unique case in Hong Kong. In most countries, it was, you know, it returned to the top 20 perhaps, but not to number one. So I think it does prove the love affair between Hong Kong and the band, Linkin Park as well. So sorry to have quite a sad top five today.
Karen, will you be delving back into the archive, getting the old Linkin Park records out?
Oh, I always do that. Every time somebody dies, I'm thinking, oh yeah, it wasn't a bad song actually. And then I feel bad that somebody had died for me to listen to the music.
I like Numb, but the Numb Encore with Jay-Z is even better. And I've rarely been more excited for a film than when that track came on in the trailer for Miami Vice. I was like, oh my God. And then I saw Miami Vice, unfortunately. But yeah, one of the great, like, all-time trailer song moments that was when that was used.
And there's that nice thing, isn't there, with trailers, when there's a moment like that. Yeah. So much promise. Okay, it's subsequently dashed, but you have
you
that moment
go back
and
to
it
the
lives
trailer.
On.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes they don't use it in the movie, which really makes me angry. Yeah.
So maybe watch that trailer again and skip the Maud trailer.
Yeah, I think so. That's, I'm not going to be going
that's the
back
big take
returning
away
to the Maudie trailer for years to come. Unlikely.
Very sage, as ever. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks, of course, to Karen. Thanks to Tim. The show is produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando. Thanks to them as well. I'm Tom Edwards. To play us out, let's hear a little bit more of that number one track from Hong Kong, from Linkin Park, and thank you for listening.
Feeling so faithless, lost under the surface. Don't know what you're